Hence, my complaint against copyright, it violates the natural and common law rights that we would otherwise enjoy to freely use our voices, pens, and presses. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, and the Libertarian Institute. Today, I am joined by Tom W. Bell, the author of Your Next Government, From the Nation State to Stateless Nations, and Intellectual Privilege, Copyright, Common Law, and the Common Good. He's a professor at Chapman University's Fowler School of Law and an adjacent fellow at the Cato Institute. Mr. Bell, thank you so much for your time. Where's the best place to find your archive of work?
Well, I guess the best single one-stop shopping place is tomwbell.com, my website. Can't promise all the links are up to date, but that's probably the best source to find out more about my work.
Great. All of those, including the books discussed, will be in the description below. Mr. Bell, what is the thesis of your book, Your Next Government, From Nation State to Stateless Nations?
It is Your Next Government. Basically, it describes a revolution, a quiet revolution, that is transforming governments across the globe from the bottom up and the inside out. And I think for Friends of Liberty, it's Friends of Humanity in general. It's basically a good news, exciting news. That's what the book is about, describing this revolution and what it means for people everywhere.
What is polycentric law?
Polycentric law. Yes, if you go to Wikipedia's page for polycentric law, they cite my my early work on that of many years ago now. Basically, polycentric law is something presented in contrast to monocentric law. Monocentric law basically being, it's basically the only kind of law most people think about. They think about a king or a parliament or a legislature that issues commands from on high, and we robot-like, or perhaps with some hesitation, we follow those rules, and they think that's the law. And it is a kind of law, and it has its virtues, but I don't think our understanding of law is complete without an understanding of how the law can arise from the bottom up, from many different sources. That's what polycentric means, from many different centers of, I'll say power, but it's not really using force. It's more like soft power, many different centers of authority, we could say, how they interact. So you have your church tells you when you should fast, and your business tells you when you should show up to the office, and your HOA tells you whether or not you can fly a flag. All these things together, overlapping jurisdictions, combine to regulate our lives in a polycentric system.
This exposes one of the greatest contradictions in modern times. We so often hear about we need a state because monopolies can exist. If people are left to their own devices, monopolies are bad because they can basically provide any quality in any amount at any time, and consumers don't really have the leverage to opt out, go elsewhere. They don't face the incentive of competition. However, with regards to the state, they want a monopoly on law, a monopoly on the currency, monopoly on taxation, monopoly on regulation. How has this, either historically or just philosophically, been communicated to people so they accept monopoly in this area, but actually aggressively are against it in all other areas?
Well, psychologically, what's going on is, I think, quite understandable. People want simple answers. The world's a very disturbing, troubling, scary place, and it's, oh, just so wonderful when some big authority figure that you can trust, whether it's Santa Claus or some other figure with a long white beard or the state, someone like that walks in and says, you know, it's under my control and I'm on your side. Beautiful vision. Alas, the world does not allow that to come to fruition in happy ways. When you give one party, even a saint, absolute power, they tend to abuse it. You can maybe set aside saints because they're theologically in a different category, but certainly humans. And for earthly governance, we are stuck with not angels, but humans, and giving them complete power results in complete disaster. I want to clarify one thing, though. I would not use, I know everyone else says monopoly. I try to avoid that word. I prefer to talk about market power for reasons I could get into, but I do agree with your characterization. Most people certainly think, oh, it'd be good to have all the power in one place. It's scary to have, they're worried about unseemly competition. It's scary to have people competing or organizations competing, especially for the law. They worry because then you'll have, armed warfare. That's how we'll settle law disputes. And of course, if you study history and human nature, economics, anthropology, you discover that's just not what happens. But it's a valid concern, and that's why people rush to embrace monocentric law, because of ignorance of the alternatives and fear.
You make a conscious effort when discussing polycentric law to often get back to the foundations of law, the nature of law itself. What is something about the nature of law which people may not appreciate or may not come to mind immediately?
Sure. Most people, when they hear law, they think of you know, police officers with badges, and you know, judges with gavels, legislators expounding on what the laws will be. They think about just one source of law. They're really thinking about what I call commands. They're thinking about orders from on high. They think that's what law is. But that's not the only view of law. I prefer the view of law that borrows from Lon Fuller's definition of law. He was a famous jurisprudent. A student of jurisprudence, a scholar, and he said the law is the enterprise of subjecting human conduct to the governance of rules. I'll say that again. The law is the enterprise of subjecting human conduct to the governance of rules. And the reason I keep hitting the enterprise hard is because Lon Fuller hits enterprise hard. And the idea is it's an ongoing process. I like enterprise both because it's an ongoing process and it does suggest, so a private enterprise could do that. Yes, absolutely. Indeed, private enterprises probably on a day-to-day basis, minute-to-minute basis, give us most of the laws that really regulate our lives. If you think about it, you know, live in an HOA, you wake up in the morning, it's already kind of controlling what you do. And there is a legislature out there beyond the walls of your HOA, and if you drive around the streets, it'll tell you what to do. But the point is, a couple points is, law comes from many sources, and it's an ongoing process. And when you have that view of the law, when you see someone issuing an order and they say, you must wear your masks in public because it's a pandemic, you can recognize that as a kind of law, but it's only one kind, and it's very frequently not the best kind.
Yes. What is the difference between this rule of law and, say, legislation?
The what in legislature?
Rule of law versus legislation, if there is any.
Yes. So the rule of law is a very popular concept, not always understood. It's easy to confuse the rule of law with having a bunch of orders written down that you can read and understand. In fact, however, which is what legislatures do. Legislatures say, you know, here's the thing we're going to order you to do today. And that is a type of law. But in fact, as the founders wrote about this, having orders written down very quickly erodes the rule of law for a couple of reasons. One is, and this is certainly true of the United States, most developed countries, there's so many orders on the books, we basically don't know what they are. It's impossible for any human, even a team of humans, even a whole law firm of humans, to understand all the rules that allegedly apply to our behavior. And so basically writing down more orders erodes the rule of law, because there's so many things you're supposed to do, no one can understand it all, and effectively it makes us all pretty much criminals all the time. Which is great if you're an authority who has a badge, because then you can walk up to somebody you don't like and you'll find something. You will find something they've done wrong. So that's one contrast between legislation and the rule of law. Another thing to observe is when you give a legislature power, it's going to be influenced by people who want to borrow some of that power, who want to influence that power. And that, too, erodes the rule of law. So even if they were angels in legislatures, just issuing a bunch of orders, well-intended, well-informed orders, does not give you actually order in society. There's a difference between giving orders and creating order. If you give too many orders, you destroy order. And the other problem is, and that's assuming angels, well-informed legislators who really care. But of course, it's not what we have. We have humans, and they are influenced by special interests. And so we get a lot of orders, too many, that aren't even good orders for the public good. Now, yeah, it helps that special interest over there. It helps that special interest over there. It doesn't help me. It doesn't help the public in general. It's a double whammy for the rule of law, and it has really eroded the rule of law in this country. It's very difficult for us. I'm speaking as a lawyer here. I have problems every day trying to figure out what my clients can do. And I wish I could say I always know, and I don't. No one can know.
So we have shortcomings in both systems. There can be shortcomings in polycentric law and monolithic law. Are there any strengths that polycentric law has that monotheistic, monopolistic law does not have.
Yes, and to be fair, there are pros and cons on both sides of this. Part of my book, Your Next Government, I have a whole chapter in here called The Center of the Law. And the thesis of that chapter is, although I'm one of the foremost proponents of polycentric law, to me it's just another way of understanding the law, which is complementary to monocentric. But the real thing that should be at the heart of any legal system is choice, is consent, is what people want as their laws. That's the only way to get justification of the legal system that applies. So I want to say there's pros and cons on both sides. Here's some of the, I can talk about the disadvantages of polycentric law. Most people see those immediately. They're immediately alarmed by, oh my gosh, it could be chaos, it could be anarchy in the bad sense. And granted, that can be a problem. Upsides of polycentric law, many. First of all, it tends to be from the bottom up versus the top down. And that gives us, if it's done right, an organic, adaptable, consent-based approach to regulating human conduct. Because the church I join by choice. No one forces me to go to that church. And when I move into that HOA, I choose it. And if I join that job, and it does regulate my behavior. My employer, for example, my employer has me do COVID-19 testing. Regulates my behavior. But I chose that job. So this allows me to live in a system of rules that I have chosen, which is much better from my point of view, and I would say society's point of view, than having a few legislators off in Washington, D.C. on the other side of the country order me around. I don't agree to that. You can make an argument, well, you know, I voted and you're in a democratic system, so you do agree. And those are very bad arguments. It is not good arguments. I don't choose that the way I choose my job or my church. So that's a nice thing about polycentric law. It's consent-based. It's organic. It's from the bottom up. Now I could say some more good things, but I'll just pause there. You can see right there, well, you know, that does sound appealing. If it doesn't go off the rails, that could be pretty good. And indeed, that is the case.
I certainly agree. Polycentric law has the most vital regulation human beings can have in society, the freedom to disassociate with bad actors and stop funding them. So that is why I think, yes, there are shortcomings in every system anyone could think of, but that's why I think polycentric law is economically and morally superior. Ayn Rand was very vocal against this type of thing. So her ultimate refutation, which she didn't expand on for us, so we're going to be limited here. A and B have a dispute, and A belongs to company C, and B belongs to company E. Therefore, instead of them already dealing with the same people to settle this dispute, they have other people doing it who are not cooperating with each other. So, I have one opinion, someone else has the other. It escalates because neither of us want to give an inch. War breaks out. Not just between me and you, between our neighbors, our cities, our states. Planetary Mad Max resolves just because Tom W. Bell wanted to sell some books. What do you think is the, what is your response to Ayn Rand's objection to polycentric law?
Oh, this was an objection. I thought she was offering a defense. So she objects to having an independent third party resolve disputes? That can't be right.
She supports a monopoly lawmaker because if there is not a monopoly, competitors will go to war. Right.
Okay.
I'm sorry I did that in an annoying way.
It's been a while since I've read Ayn Rand on this, but now you're refreshing my memory. That's right. She's definitely... She does believe, like a lot of friends of liberty, that we have to have a central, single authority resolve disputes. Well, here's the fault with that argument, among other faults. I'll just go to the big one. Who's going to judge the judger? Just like, you know, who's going to watch the watchman? Who's going to guard the guards? And indeed, with all due respect to Ayn Rand, we very much live in the system she advocated, and it's a flipping disaster in this sense. The system we live in, I have a dispute against the government. Say they're violating my First Amendment rights, or I have some complaint about COVID-19. Indeed, I wrote three op-eds about COVID-19 policies, and they violated a lot of constitutional liberties. And I actually talked with people, lawyers, about litigating this, and basically it's gone nowhere. Why? Because if I go to a local superior court, assuming I'm suing the state of California, I'm appearing before an employee of the state of California. That judge is employed by the state of California. And I'm there to say, hey, the parties who are on the other side of your W-2, the folks who send you your paycheck, your employer, I got a problem with them. Oh, says the judge. Well, come tell me your complaint against my employer, the source of my income, the institution which very carefully chose me to fulfill its will. Please tell me your complaints against that party. And the judge will hear my complaint and will not give me a fair hearing, frankly. Everywhere else in the world, we say, you cannot judge your own case. And somehow we're going to make an exception for the state itself. I have to go to the state's court, whether it's federal or local U.S. state, to have adjudicated my claims against that institution. Now, we would never accept that in the private sector. If I had a complaint against, say, Hertz Rent-A-Car, I rent a car at the airport, and the arbitration agreement says all disputes will be resolved by arbitration before a panel composed of the CEO, CFO, and COO of Hertz. No other court would respect that arbitration clause because it's facially invalid. And indeed, if you go back to the roots of classical liberalism, John Locke talked about this among others, but Locke's a good starting point. He said, the reason we need a state is because we need a neutral arbiter between contesting parties. And there I'll say, absolutely right about needing a neutral arbiter, Locke, but blind, perhaps, as was Rand, to the problem of having the government judge the cases against it. And if you want to know how that's worked out, look at the United States. Beautiful Bill of Rights. The language is perfect. How has it been interpreted? It's been gutted. It basically, you can't read a single word in the Bill of Rights and take any of it seriously. No law? What does no law mean? It does not mean no law. It means what the Supreme Court thinks it means, which means a lot of laws are okay, actually, restricting speech. And how did that happen? Those judges worked for the federal government. They were chosen by senators. Those are not the people you want resolving your disputes against the government. That's what we got. I hope you like it, Rand. That's not so good for us. We're living under it, and our rights are being violated day by day.
There is a great article written by a gentleman from, I believe it was, New Mexico University, Alfred Kuzan, where he says that there's only different types of anarchy. There really is no world without anarchy. For example, we currently live where 200-plus countries live in a state of anarchy amongst one another. There's no world pope ruling Brazil, China, and America. And even if you did usher in a world government, well, if people are corrupt and they need regulation, well, who gives the license to the United Nations to give us all licenses to have law? So it seems that every criticism thrown our way not only technically applies to us, it applies to them tenfold because they don't face competition and you can't opt out of funding them. What are some economic benefits? If I really want to say, I just want legal services to be better. If I want those to improve, why should I advocate this position instead of a statist position where I definitely have taxpayers guaranteeing me courts and police and juries, et cetera?
Well, I mean, it's the same sort of phenomenon in the law that you see everywhere. When you have a state-subsidized service, it is overconsumed. And basically, that's what we see with regard to state-funded adjudication. People will litigate because they don't have to pay the judge directly out of pocket. So if two private parties go before a local federal district court to adjudicate their business dispute, I'm paying for their adjudicating services. Why am I paying for that? Do I have skin in that game? I mean, I have a very distant interest in there being peace in society. I don't want these people to, you know, go at it with hammer and tongs or worse yet, firearms to settle their business dispute. But of course, that's not what would happen. Business people realize violence is very costly. So what they can do and what they frequently do, especially when they're interested in having their dispute resolved quickly, is they go to private arbitration. But a complaint you hear from business people about private arbitration is, golly, it's expensive. Well, compared to what? We'll go into that public court over there. Well, that's because I'm paying for that public court. Why am I paying for these two parties to have their dispute resolved? Should I pay to have, should you get, you know, state funding to have umpires, you know, adjudicate ball games? No, that's between people on the field. Have them pay for it. So the question is, why are the rest of us subsidizing it? Not for very good reasons. And it results in overconsumption of litigation services. And by the way, provision of below market or low quality services. It's just like socialized medicine. You don't have to pay out of pocket, but good luck getting your heart transplant surgery. So you go to public court, you don't have to pay for that judge, not directly, but good luck trying to get a fast decision. You're not going to get it. And so in very parallel cases, if you love socialized medicine, you're going to really love the way they run public courts in America. If you have problems with dying under the watch of some government employee, maybe you should think twice about whether government-funded courts are such a great idea.
The idea of private firms and churches and HOAs being the centers of law versus a state was illustrated in a book called The Capitalist Case for a Stateless Society, Spontaneous Order. Chase Rachel says, the illegitimacy of the state rests on the fact that it exercises control over resources that its agents never acquired through original appropriation or voluntary exchange, and it does so without the consent of the rightful owners of said resources. How do you respond to that?
That's not far from right, but it's not the way I would put it in several respects. I'm going to start with consent. I think many friends of liberty make this mistake. I used to have this view myself, and I walked away from it because I decided it was a mistake. I used to say the state is, there's no basis for its authority. I didn't consent to it. Lysander Spooner's no treason argument. I didn't sign the Constitution. I'm not bound. That's a very appealing argument, but it's too simple. I think, in fact, consent is a matter of degree. And basically what we want to do, I'll show you an illustration if I can find it from my book quickly. Oh, yes, here we go. I don't know if it'll show to your readers, but you can find, by the way, all these illustrations on my website, tomwbell.com, because I've made them available for listeners of the audiobook. And what this simple illustration shows is that the justification of the exercise of legal authority is a question of degree, and it co-varies with consent. Consent is a matter of degree. Too many libertarians, too many people generally, have this view of consent. They think it's like this. It's yes or no.
Yeah.
You either agree or you don't. And friends, that is not the world. When you study the law, as law professors do, and lawyers generally, you discover there's all kinds of shades of consent. And so libertarians are very fond of saying, you know, it's, you don't give me this, you know, love it or leave it argument. Don't pretend I'm bound by the United States Constitution just because I'm living here. They can't force me to leave the country. That's totally of no significance. And I just say, that's not a realistic view, friend. You're right to be skeptical that you can justify much by saying you didn't leave the country, but I think it's just wrong and a little silly to say I'm just as bound by the Constitution as I am, say, the Constitution of Botswana, that they're all on the same level. I just don't think that's what most people really think. I don't even think libertarians think that. I think they're being a little bluff and bold and doing their libertarian flash, you know, look how libertarian I am. Are you shocked? That's great fun if you're a young libertarian who wants to shock people. It's not persuasive because it's not accurate. Instead, you need a more, well, sophisticated view of consent, that it varies by degree, that there's something, not a lot, but there is actually something to be said for implied consent. Not a lot. The important thing to recognize is that we want to climb this ladder of consent to the gold standard. The gold standard is express consent between adults who are not under any kind of coercion, who have the ability to negotiate, they have exit options, they have choices. That's the ideal. Getting that ideal implemented in a political context is a very difficult thing. We're not going to get there right away. We're not going to get there by crossing our arms and stomping our feet and saying, I didn't agree to this Constitution. It has no impact on me. It's just not going to be effective. Instead, we got to recognize we're heading that way. Be patient. It'll take time. But there, we can make progress towards that goal.
In your paper, The Constitution, As If Consent Mattered, you cite Lysander Spooner, where he says, where would be the end of fraud and litigation if one party could bring into court a written instrument without any signature and claim to have it enforced upon the ground that it was written for another man to sign, that this other man had promised to sign it, that he ought to have signed it, that he had the opportunity to sign it if he would, but that he had refused or neglected to do so, yet that is the most that could ever be said of the Constitution. So what is a productive way to understand consent and contract?
Well, first of all, I'll say I love that quote. That's why I put it in that paper. It's in the book, too, and I'm a huge fan of Lysander Spooner, but again, it's too simplistic. So I'll just give you an example from the law. I see this argument used a lot by economists, people who think in terms of economics. Because why? Because they're only thinking about market transactions, where it's definitely the case. You either have the deal or you don't. You buy that apple or you don't. You pay them the money, you get the service, or you don't. It is black and white in that context. But that's not the way the world works for a lawyer. Lawyers have to deal with all kinds of cases which are kind of confusing. It's not really clear whether somebody consented, and yet they're interacting. You got to do something. I'll give you an example. Tottenham versus Wisdom, old case. Guy falls off a streetcar. He hits his head on the curb. He's laying unconscious in the street, and a couple of doctors come up and they render aid. And unfortunately, the guy passes away. He never comes to consciousness, but they do give him some care in his last moments, and they ask for payment from the estate. Now, under that Lysander Spooner, very simplistic black and white view, what are you going to say? You're kind of at a loss. You say, well, I guess they didn't bargain. I guess the doctors don't get paid. Well, that doesn't feel right because it's not right. Those doctors should get paid. Well, how are you going to solve this problem? You're going to use the law. And the law will say, after it kind of scratches its chin and looks at other cases and thinks things through, basically they're going to do what the court in that case did in Cotton versus Wisdom. They said, the doctor should get paid something on the basis of kind of a quasi-contract or hypothetical consent. If the guy had been conscious, he probably would have said, please, your doctors, I'm in pain and I need help, please render care. He wasn't able to say that, so we are reconstructing his consent hypothetically, but that's pretty sensible. Now, the question in a political context is, should we resort to hypothetical consent with regard to the Constitution? And Lysander Spooner basically says, no way, it doesn't work at all. And I say to Lysander Spooner, I have my doubts about hypothetical consent also, but it's wrong to say it equals zero. That's just kind of immature. It's not sophisticated. It does not reflect the way, and Lysander should have known this because he was a legally educated fellow. That's not the way lawyers think about it because that's not the real world. So what we should have, again, is recognize hypothetical consent better than nothing. Better than nothing, it's probably not as good as implied consent, and implied consent is not as good as express consent. But don't throw out those second-rate things as worthless. They are a path towards what we really want, which is express consent.
And would you say that people often just engage in implied consent so often just because it's economically efficient and, you know, a little more pleasant? Imagine every time you go to a restaurant, do you agree to pay for what you just asked me for? Okay, here's exactly how big it's going to be. By fries on the side, we mean 19 fries exactly, because 18 would be ripping you off and 21 would be spoiling you rotten. So yes, of course, we have implied consent. There's another argument for polycentric law. The world is terribly complex. Therefore, the last thing we would want is a coercively funded monopoly. And instead, we should have voluntarily funded competition to sort out such complexity.
I like your example, and your conclusion is sound also. Another nice thing about polycentric law is it lets us discover the rules that will allow us to live together in peace and prosperity. And people don't always get it right. They leave clubs and churches because they're badly governed, or look at all the communist communes that have fallen apart. People gave it a try, and it just doesn't work time and again. Well, let them run that experiment, and the rest of us will stand back and learn. Thank you very much.
What is spontaneous order and why is it important?
Spontaneous order. It's not really the best phrase, but it is the one we're kind of stuck with. I have a series of videos. You can find them at tomwbell.com. I did a series of videos for Learn Liberty, which is a wonderful service put online by the Institute for Humane Studies. And one of them is on spontaneous orders. So I've used that phrase. I prefer unplanned order. Mm. Unplanned order. Spontaneous makes it sound like poof, it just appears out of nowhere. But let me take a step back. What we're talking about with unplanned or spontaneous order is basically the order that arises in society, not because of some central authority saying so it shall be, but rather because people in the field in their workaday lives figure out the rules that work And sometimes they look over the fence and they go, oh, I'm going to do it like them because it worked. And these rules kind of spread horizontally through society, not because the king or the parliament said so, but because people realize, to use your example, this is a good way to run a restaurant. Well, you know, you just have people walk in assuming if you order food, you're going to pay for it. That's a good assumption. And then you have, you know, some reasonable things that go along with that. So that's a spontaneous or unplanned order. It's really what gets us through everyday life. Why can I go to a restaurant and they don't have to say, let me be very clear what the rules are here, blah, blah. They don't do that. They don't have to. I don't need it. I don't want it. We've learned that from experience, and restaurants really work well. So that's an unplanned order, sort of the restaurant economy, in that central authorities did not say, how are we going to build a restaurant economy? Let's think this through and have some experts, professors of restaurant commerce figure it out. No. That's not what happened. And yet, if you go out on the town, restaurant after restaurant, they do it more or less the same way. Works great. Basically, those rules came about through an unplanned process. Each restaurant is planned, of course. It has an owner, a manager, a chef, and they work it all out. But the overall system, and more broadly, not just the restaurant economy, but the whole economy, very orderly. It's what I call, it relies on what I call distributed regulation. I think I need to introduce this phrase more widely. Libertarians often get pegged with this idea, oh, you like no regulation. Oh, of course not. I want lots of regulation, actually. I love rules. I'm a lawyer, but they have to be rules that I choose. That's the important thing. Regulation is great as long as it is chosen freely by the people who are subject to those regulations. And that's what you get from what I call distributed regulation. We have property rights everywhere. That results in a regular, orderly, peaceful society. It's regulated in that sense, in the sense it's a regularized society. So you can have regulation without a regulator. You can get it from regulators, plural, and together they work it out. And that's the order we get. We call it an unplanned or spontaneous order, and that's really what puts the meat on the bones of society. That's what makes it possible for you and I to walk down the street, not be attacked, go to a restaurant, have a nice meal, pay them money. It all works beautifully. That's not because of legislators or judges or kings. That's because it came from the bottom up.
And it's very often in spite of people trying to coercively interfere with large-scale voluntary interactions. Someone who thinks they have the right to rule peaceful people comes in and starts writing up, here are the OSHA regulations, and here's the Department of Health, and here's the Department of Agriculture. For some reason, they either don't call each other, or they call each other just to mess with us, because so often they contradict one another, especially in the restaurant industry. I think unplanned order. I'm done with spontaneous order. I'm officially calling it unplanned, because spontaneous means we can all sit around there. We don't need entrepreneurs. It's just going to sort of fall from the sky. Unplanned order is important because if we say government provides X, X equals the law, and you don't have a monopoly state to provide X, well, then X won't exist. But if you understand unplanned order, well, then you realize that government is not the source of the law. It is one method of expression to try and monopolize this thing we know as the law. As far as the daily examples of it, is this just something large scale, like economies or restaurants, or are there everyday examples of things we run into where unplanned order is something we're actually able to see and experience?
Oh my, yes, of course. Well, we could start with language, English. Is there a central authority telling us that, you know, that woot, W-0-0-T is a word? No. We figure that out for ourselves. We see it in, you know, we're on Discord and we see people use it and we pick it up ourselves. No one's regulating English and it works great. It seems to be working pretty well. Maybe it's not perfect, but I think it's better than what we could get out of Washington, D.C. How about the rules of simple politeness? You know, I recognize when I see somebody in a shop and they smile at me, I smile back. They say, well, how are you today? And I don't say, none of your business. I say, how are you? It's a bit rote, perhaps. But it greases the wheels and lets us get along peaceably with a smile, makes our days pleasant. Nobody says, thou shalt reply, fine, thank you, if someone asks you how you are. We learn that because we're socialized. And that really is most of our days. Most of the time, if you think about you know, at the end of the day and you're sitting down to dinner with your loved ones, you're talking about your day. If you actually had an encounter with the hard law from, you know, the monocentric authorities, that's like the big thing you're going to talk about. It's a notable event. And the police officer pulled me over. He said one of my taillights was out. You know, I didn't know. That's a big story. That's like a huge event. But most of your day, you're actually obeying the law, not violating rights. Everything's peaceful. But you don't talk about that at dinner because it's the most natural thing in the world. It pervades our lives. And it's a good thing because those rules are chosen. They're customary. They're natural. Those aren't a surprise. That's what humans are built for. It's the stuff that comes from the king. That's what shocks us. It's an unnatural. It's alarming. It's often a disaster.
Definitely. And often totally inconsistent in its application. Taking by force is wrong unless you call it taxation. Violently dominating is wrong unless you call it regulation. You can't kill anyone. That's bad. Excuse us while we engage in what we call foreign policy and collateral damage. Well, of course, these are just blatant double standards that if the law applied equally, then we could actually get some consistency. Even when people will say, I made this sandwich from scratch. Well, did they grow the onions? Did they build the car they made to go get the groceries from the store? Did they mine the gasoline and refine it themselves? It's really incredible that when you see the chain of events that allows us to have something as simple as, of course, Leonard Reed gave us the pencil example.
Yep.
Are there ways that something like self-interest can be harnessed in such a way to promote the public good?
Well, yes, of course, and thankfully so. I mean, I mostly deal in the law, but I can start with the economic principles of freedom of contract, respect for individuals, and property rights. Those, to me, are the three big P's of the common law. Persons, you're protected under tort law. People can't assault and batter you. If they do that, you have a lawsuit. That's tort law. Promises, basically contract law, and then property rights. You know, you get to own your chattel property, you get to own real property. And so, you know, all three of those things, those are things we want to respect in society, and it gives us order and peace and prosperity.
Now, very often we hear about, that people are self-interested, and what we need is one organization. Maybe it's the state, maybe it's something else. We need something above society in order to make sure people are acting for the greater good. So you and I can engage in, let's call it a voluntary exchange, but think about all the pollution that third parties have to bear. So does the existence of externalities and a greater good promoting the general welfare, do you think that is a shortcoming in the polycentric law field or the libertarian worldview?
Right. I didn't actually answer your prior question. I'll return to that, and then I'll pick up this new one. And that you did ask about self-interest. So I'll say under those three big P's, people seeking their own self-interest generally reach pretty good results. You and I enter into a contract because it's in both our interests, and it's also in our interest to go have it adjudicated by a third party. You and I do not want to come to fisticuffs over our dispute. That's just not good business. You and I will both recognize, let's go to someone and do it peaceably. And so mostly that works, but there are cases where there are problems, most notably with regard to negative externalities and public goods. Those are like the hard problems. It's not clear always that we can solve those problems through private, self-interested agents acting under a system of rules. It may turn out that those agents have strong incentives to pollute, to cast off costs on innocents who don't have standing to sue or who won't, in the aggregate, be able to get together to defend their rights. And also, of course, you have shirkers, people who say, I very much like enjoying national defense. I'm very happy the Chinese are not here trying to throw me in a prison camp. Thank you, U.S. Navy and Marines and Air Force, Army, but I don't want to pay for that. I don't want to pay for that because it's costly. And so, yeah, I'm just going to enjoy the benefits. So there's, you know, there are problems. Those are recognized in theory. In practice, well, you know, in practice, it's funny. The more and more you look at the particular examples, for example, lighthouses used to be the classic example of, we got to have a government who would provide a lighthouse. Why would a private party ever provide a lighthouse? We must have government. Well, it turns out when you look at history, private lighthouses are actually pretty common, or were at one time, before the government got involved. And it was funded, by the way, in case your listeners are wondering, well, why would private parties ever fund a lighthouse? It was done in different ways, but sometimes, typically in England, those are the historical examples that have been drawn from there, it was a local port would for their purposes of that local port facility, put up the lighthouse. It's a helps maritime commerce. Doesn't do them any good to have a port if everybody coming into port and leaving hits those rocks and sinks. So they have an economic incentive to create a lighthouse, even though ships just sailing past also say, well, I'm not going to that port, but I know to steer away from those rocks. Many, many examples that of so-called public goods actually being provided privately, because it doesn't have to be perfect to work. It just has to be better than nothing. Now, that said, I don't want to pretend that every single negative externality can be solved, that every single public good can be provided by private parties. I'm just going to say skepticism in the face of people who claim you have to do it with a state is warranted. Time and again, when you poke those claims and look at history and theory, they just don't hold up.
Yeah, Lawrence Reed, president emeritus of FEE, always likes to say, you know, we advocates of free market and voluntary exchange are always expected to come up with all these specific examples of how everything is going to work and all these historical examples and understandings, whereas our opponents are just asked to make sure that they have good intentions. Do you think intentions matter with regard to the law? For example, me slipping, stabbing someone and killing them versus me not liking that someone didn't watch my interview with Tom Bell stabbing them. How much do intentions matter when dealing with the law?
Matter a great deal. To give a lawyerly answer, it does depend. In fact, a little joke for your non-lawyer listeners is that the correct legal answer to any question is it depends. That's always the yeah. You have to put in a lot of words after that to make it useful, but it always depends. So with regard to your particular question, it depends on the claim in question, for example. If you and I have a contract, so suppose we have a contract and I'm supposed to supply you with paper cups every week. You're running some kind of restaurant, you need paper cups. And, you know, I don't supply enough cups one week. And, oh, I meant well. I tried to deliver the cups, but my car broke down. And it's not really my fault, is it? I had the purest of intentions. You don't care. You're going to say, look, buddy, don't even talk to me about this. I'm running a business. I don't have time. I'm going to sue you for breach. You didn't deliver the cups. But. And you're not going to hear the but. You're going to say, because this is true, breach of contract is a strict liability offense. You do it or you don't. We don't want to hear your excuses. However, in other areas, it makes a huge difference. If, for example, I'm walking down the street and somehow we come into contact, it makes a big difference. Whether I was looking at my phone and I bumped into you by accident, then it might be negligence. Versus me walking up to you and you have your back turned and I go up and I hit you in the back of the head because I want to, you know, offend you. Well, there's a huge difference there. The first is a mere claim of negligence. The second is a claim of battery. I might face punitive damages. It could even be criminal battery. And especially in criminal law, too, intent matters intensely. So it does depend, and I think rightfully so. Sometimes we should care about intentions. It makes a huge difference to me whether somebody bumped into me by accident or whether they're assaulting me. And sometimes, really, we don't care. If I'm running a business, I don't give a toot. I got to have those paper cups. I don't want to hear talk. Just deliver them or don't. And if you don't deliver them, nothing personal, buddy. Just business. You got to pay my damages, and I'll probably find somebody else to do the job.
Let's say that I am living in an apartment and they say, you can stay here as long as you like. You have to pay rent. You can't, I can't even remember the original example. You have to pay rent on time. Can't play loud music after from midnight to 4 a.m. And you can't initiate violence against any of the people anywhere, but especially in the apartment complex. And then they find out that I watched an R-rated movie, and they say, well, what you're kind of doing is engaging in promoting violent behaviors, which could lead to violence. So that's why we are kicking you out of your apartment. Immediately, all your stuff is on the front lawn. Would you say that is a breach of contract?
Is that a what contract?
A breach of contract.
Breach of contract. Well, there's a couple of problems with the hypo. One is, it doesn't sound like there was any adjudication of this claim. So what, the apartment owner is the judge, jury, and executioner? That's not the way the law works. They should go to an independent third party to adjudicate their dispute. So there's that. And also, with regard to leaseholds in particular, that's a whole body of contracts which is not it's not regulated strictly and only by contract law. A leasehold estate, that's what lawyers will say, property lawyers, is a form of property right. And as such, you have certain protections against being suffering expropriation. So there's a couple of reasons why in practice in our society, and thank goodness, it would not work out that way. So, you know, there's a couple of problems with the hypo, and I'd say happily that's not in a liberal society. And by the way, when I use liberal, I mean, surprise, surprise, of or pertaining to liberty. You will not hear escape from my lips the word liberal being used to describe left wing. And if I hear people do that, they will get at least a very dark thought and sometimes some words of correction. Friends of Liberty should never let left wing people take the word liberal. That is a different word. They don't merit its use. They can be progressives. That's a fine word. They can be left wing and also a good word. But anyhow, in a liberal society, which ideally we live in, you can't do that stuff, and it's a good thing. There are protections under contract and property law.
The reason I mention that hypothetical is because I think it's, please correct me if I'm wrong, somewhat analogous to the big tech organizations, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, saying, come on our platform, you can't advocate violence and you can't have images of children underage without clothes, anything like that, come on. And then, you know, someone says, we need to fight for the right to pass this legislation, or we're going to bring the fight to the White House. Well, fight is often used as a way of aggressively communicating a message to convince a large number of people. But they're saying, oh, fight, that's violence. And your entire account is banned immediately. Thousands of years of work. You can't promote violence. And by that, we mean things that harm people. And what you're saying is in line with the World Health Organization guidelines of COVID. So therefore, that harms people. So we're going to shut off James Corbett's entire account. That's why I asked, because there is a philosophical understanding that applies very, very much so today. Anything else you have on breach of contract or anything in that area?
Well, let's speak to that example directly. So let's take, the answer I gave you kind of holds up. Let's explain why. First of all, with regard to using a neutral third-party arbitrator, they don't do that. And I'm surprised. In fact, I am shocked that there's all this talk about Facebook setting up some kind of Supreme Court of Facebook, where they're going to adjudicate in-house disputes. I am amazed that no attorney out there has not done this to Facebook. What I would do if it were my client who's, say, running her business on Facebook and she gets the boot because she said something like, I'm not sure that really masks make sense. And then Facebook says, oh, that's violence. You're out of here. If they did that to my client, she's my client, well, you know, I would initiate some kind of complaint and Facebook would probably say, well, we've reviewed your complaint and no, we decided you're kicked off. And I would say, did you just adjudicate this important dispute having to do with the business situation of my client? I think you did. Well, you need to take that to third-party arbitration. Your decision is basically unconscionable because you have just judged your own case. That decision is not valid, Facebook. The fact that you think that you have to create a Supreme Court to adjudicate disputes shows that you are dealing with people's livelihoods, with their personal lives, with very important things, and you are serving Facebook as judge, jury, and executioner, that is not valid. And I bet you could get a government court to look at that and say, yeah, that's problematic, Facebook. We get to review this. And Facebook will want to hide behind their user agreement, and the answer is, hey, Hertz can't hide behind their contract to have disputes with Hertz adjudicated by their corner office executives. They can't do that. You can't do it either, Facebook. The other problem with the social media like Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, is Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act. I used to be a qualified fan of Section 230, which offers certain exemptions to, social media platforms. Other people get it, but it's the social media platforms we worry about. Offers certain exemptions to them, really privileged treatment under the law of defamation, which I don't think they merit. I think it's a mistake. And in fact, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera, should be facing liability for defamation. And if they were held to the same laws that apply to everyone else, it would be disruptive to their business model, but it would be better in the long run for everybody.
What is the thesis of your book, Regulator's Revenge?
Regulator's Revenge. That was a book I put out with Solveig Singleton at the Cato Institute when I was director of telecommunications and technology studies there. And Solveig and I put out a book to basically review the impact of the 1996 Telecommunications Act, which was heralded as a vast and important reform of telecommunications law in the United States. No doubt telecommunications law needed reform. No doubt the 96 Act did a few good things, to be sure. On that, mixed blessing. And that book reviewed basically took a critical look at the 96 Act after it had been enforced for a few years and basically evaluated it and found some problems. Lots of problems.
You wrote a paper, The Paths of Intellectual Property, or Intellectual Privilege, as you call it, in 2007, and you referred to public goods as being non-excludable and non-rivalrous in consumption. Great lighthouse example that Ronald Coase made populace aware of. And you say that this includes such things as national defense, which protects all citizens regardless of whether they pay or how many they number. Well, what if we took that and reversed it? For example, the founders of Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, Abdullah Azzam, Musab al-Zarqawi, and Ayman al-Zawahiri, all say that they want to attack the U.S. because it supports Israel, which initiates aggression in Lebanon and against Palestinians, and they blockaded Iraq a decade before 9/11 and bombed it an average of twice a week for, 5 or 10 years. What about the negative externalities that governments give us? Could this be a justification for opting out of, quote, public goods?
It could be used that way. I'm going to answer using a slightly different analogy, which I think might resonate with your audience. I think you can argue not only is government a public good under one characterization, but so is revolution. So is revolution. So it's a funny paradoxical, so I'll explain the case for revolution. Suppose we're living under oppressive government, and we would all be better off if we could throw off those shackles. I would be better off if I didn't have all this regulation. Maybe I'm being oppressed like the Uyghurs in China. But, it's very difficult for any one person to go up against the government, especially since, if I go fight the government, I think, why am I going to go die on that front line fighting for everybody else's freedom? They're going to get the benefit. I take the hit. Not a good deal for me. So I don't have I don't join the revolution. But if nobody joins the revolution, the oppressive government remains in place and we all suffer. So it's a public goods problem. And if the revolutionaries, let's go back to those we honor, Washington, Jefferson, Franklin, Adams, all those greats of the American Revolution, they did us all a huge favor. They threw off the shackles of tyranny and they created this better form of government for us. That's a public good. We all benefited. And they basically raised funds through coercive mechanisms, which most libertarians don't seem to complain about much. But here's the funny thing. I mean, if we're back in that situation, revolution, if it's a public good, you have to have a state to provide revolution, which is kind of paradoxical, but I think that's where the theory gets you. So there's lots of things you can say about that theory. I think that in itself shows you there might be something wrong with this theory. If it kind of over-explains things. Everything's a public good, and it seems to justify, as your example demonstrates, kind of some terrible acts that we don't want to say terrorism's okay. You may feel okay about revolutionaries if they're on your side, but you would be very much against those revolutionaries if they were, Islamic radicals. You wouldn't like it at all.
Let's look at the case of the people being very hostile towards other opinions, eagerly dismissing people as a dumb communist or a dumb fascist who just wants to institute racism and other people. The reason someone could only be a leftist is because they want everyone on welfare. So let's say, all right, people have the right to say words that other people disagree with. How would you talk to someone and give them the incentive of why they should listen to people that they disagree with?
That's more of a question of rhetoric, which I think about a fair amount, but I don't spend much of my time in unstructured debates in public. I just don't think it's fruitful. I prefer to do my work in structured environments where you write a pleading or you make some kind of argument there. So I really don't have, I don't think I'm your best source for tips on rhetoric, but I'll give you a couple things. A thing I do care about is language. I think there's several things Friends of Liberty are doing wrong. One is calling people on the left liberal. Why are you giving them that word? I've had this argument with many libertarians, and they say things like, you know, that word is lost. And I say, well, fine, you think that. I don't. But you don't have to give it to the other side. You ought to at least put it in no man's land. Why are you giving up that word? That's our word. Fight the fight. Fight for that word. Another thing I think is important is to not say, you know, have you already heard this, to introduce ideas like instead of spontaneous order, unplanned order, to talk about distributed regulation. I'll give another one because it popped up in something you said. Taxation is theft. Oh, my goodness. How my young libertarian friends love that. It's silly, people. Taxation is not theft. It is akin to theft in some respects. But you're not making yourself look smart. You're not winning fans. You're not convincing people, Friends of Liberty, running around and yelling that at the top of your voice. This may be hard to hear, but when you say that, other people stop taking you seriously because they see on the face of it, you're doing some kind of like, you know, libertarian flash. You're trying to signal to your fellow libertarians, look how radical I am. I march with Ron Paul. I get it. That's what young people want to do. But don't pretend you're convincing anybody. You're not going to go home at Thanksgiving dinner and convince your aunt to become an anarchist by saying taxation is theft. Because she's going to say, seems a little different to me. And she's going to be right. So there's some things I'll say. I'll stop there. I'm really not a specialist in public relations. I don't have the patience for that. But I do. Even I can see some things that Friends of Liberty could do better.
Yes, I believe I did a poor job of asking the question. Say a student comes to you and says, I'm not reading anything you assign by Alan Dershowitz. He taught rape law. He is promoting the legitimacy and the gray area, whereas I stand strong against this. Nor will I read anything by, you know, someone who pals around with racists or someone who pals around with the socialists, because National Socialism killed millions. Communism has killed millions. How would you tell that student you are actually benefiting you directly? It's not just for the greater good. You benefit by reading the works of Marx, Mussolini, and Dershowitz.
You know, I probably would not have that conversation, frankly. That's not my job. Happily, okay. I'm teaching law students. I have a very narrow job. I don't have to correct the whole of their lives. It's too big a job. So I'll tell you, when I see people do that, really my attitude is sort of like, I'm not paid to set you straight. This is what I think in my thought bubble. I say, I'm a professional educator. There's a lot of ignorance in the world. That's a particularly kind of like, you know, it's such a basic problem. How am I going to convince somebody to be open-minded? If they're not curious on their own, I basically look at these people kind of with sympathy, a little bit of contempt, some sympathy. And basically I just say, you know, that's your problem, people. I'm not going to tell you how to be a member of a civil society where you address ideas that you're not comfortable with. Mature adults know how to do that. If you're not like that, you need to go back to undergraduate school or something else or get a life. And I'm sorry, I'm going to get back to my business, which is more narrow. And I can assume I'm dealing with people who have goodwill and are curious about other ideas. If you're not like that, why are you even in my office? And you're not a person I want to talk to. You're closed-minded. Go be closed-minded somewhere else. So this is not my job. I don't want to take it up. That's a problem. But there's professionals like you, sir, who open people's eyes to different arguments. I don't feel like that's what I'm best at.
Thank you. Thank you. Final question. Why do you support free market capitalism?
Support is consensual relations between adults. I believe the paramount political virtue is consent. Now, I do think that is entirely consistent with freedom, but I don't start with freedom. I start with consent. Because to me, freedom puts the emphasis in the wrong place. It gets people thinking about all the stuff you can do without restraint. The important thing to me is choosing the constraints under which you will live. I believe humans are actually rule-loving animals. They love rules, but they also want to choose the rules they live under. So freedom to me is not the paramount value, except in the sense that I want to say you should be free to choose the rules that you can get other people to agree to. Freedom does not mean I get to do whatever I want because you might want to go steal my stuff. And that is not okay. Freedom means, again, living together with people under rules that you and they choose together. Hopefully you do it with express consent. You write it all down. It's super clear. No one's holding a gun to your head. You have exit options. And when you sign that dotted line, it means something. Hopefully that's the way it is. That's an ideal we're working towards. In the meantime, what we have are people in less than perfect institutions where we do have to rely on hypothetical and implied consent for want of anything better. We should always keep in mind we can do better. Let's try to climb that ladder of consent to a better place. And so that's what I'll say. You know, you want me to go to bat for capitalism? That's a much abused word. I do believe in private property rights. I think it's important to have people with a lot of capital assets they can invest in things. Huge fan, huge fan. Not what I'm going to go die. That's not the hill I'm going to die on. It's not for free markets, not for capitalism. If I'm going to go fight a fight, it's going to be for consent. And I think it gets you to the same place, and it gets you there in a more philosophically rigorous way that is also, I think, more rhetorically convincing. People who want to walk out in the public meet in the public debates carrying the flag free market capitalism, I say, that's awesome, cool. You'll probably find I'm going to be on your side of most debates, but you're going to draw a lot of fire because you're looking for a fight, frankly. But if you go out there waving the flag of consent, how are you going to argue against consent? If someone says, oh, I don't like people consenting to things, they've already marked themselves as a bully. They're going to lose that argument. All your friends are going to say, even your socialist friends, at least some of them, if they think about it, are going to look at the bully over there saying, well, I just don't respect other people's opinions. I'm just going to do what I want because I don't think consent's important. They're going to see that as kind of appalling. It's not attractive. It will not attract people. And so that's good. We don't want those people to have followers. We want to be behind the banner of consent because that's the biggest tent you can get everybody that you want to be with under that banner.
The books are Intellectual Privilege, Copyright, Common Law, and the Common Good, and Your Next Government, From the Nation State to Stateless Nations. Mr. Bell, thank you so much for your time, and thank you to everyone for watching Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone, and the Libertarian Institute.